Welcome to another edition of the Dogger Pass Podcast. This for Apex Fighting 91. Paul Shaughnessy here. Producer Megan on the sticks. Cody Saftick is on the line. Back after a week off, after being in Vegas. Vegas was exhausting. I'm 39 years old now. It was exhausting, bro. It was exhausting. I was telling Megan before you came in, it's just like, it's all well and good. And like, you know, 10 years ago, I was mucking, like, the people in the comment section are probably like, he's soft, like, look at his boot, the boot that he does the shoey out of. It's like, I get all of these things, but it's like, talk to me in 10 years when you're, you know, nearing 40 about these things. I loved it. We had a great time, don't get me wrong. But, like, after, like, 3 or 4 days in Vegas, like, you are feeling, you know, it's just overstimulation. Just like across the board, I was telling Megan, it's like, you know, you walk down in the morning, usually I'm like, you know, pounding coffees just to function in the morning. And, you know, you obviously don't have a coffee machine in your room, go down to go buy a coffee. And it's just like, everything's fine. And then you walk out into the lobby and it's just, whoo, 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 just pounding music, just slapping you in the face first thing in the morning. Takes a little bit of getting used to. But yeah, Circa was awesome. Had a great time. They, you know, provide, like, they pulled out the red carpet for us in general. It was a great opportunity. Great hotel. If you're a gambler wanting to go down there, it's like, I mean, it's the hotel that's set up for gambling. So I would highly recommend it. But, pitter patter, Cody. Let's get back at her in the Apex. You have any thoughts about, you know, last week, anything like that?
No, not really. I meant to do so many things in my week off. We had that like one little lull, but just never got to it, dude. Like you said, Vegas was an awesome time, but super exhausting. It took me a few days to recoup, and as you can see, still in the old set, which I will change. But I got till the end of the month, so. On my list of things to do, this definitely got shoved off. And you got a super big, like, hangover card now at this UFC Apex Fighting 91. Is it 91, 92?
91, so I believe. So many.
Yeah, yeah. It's a 13-fight card, and there's going to be some bangers. There's going to be some entertaining fights. But the best fight on this card would have looked vastly out of place at UFC 300. This main event on this card, had they tried to sneak that on to the very first fight of UFC 300, people would have laughed at it. So you've got just like, not a lack of talent, just like a lack of star power. There's a lot of evenly contested matchups. And when you look at these lines, the few favorites that you might like are blown out, way out of proportion. And the rest of the guys, I can make a solid argument for every single underdog. So on a betting standpoint, do not love it.
It's tricky.
It's not our job to talk about what, well, it is our job to talk about what we don't love and also find those little gems in the rough. So hopefully on a 13 fight card, we can at least find a few spots.
All right, let's get into it. We got Mateusz Nicolaou taking on Alex Perez, minus 185 for Nicolaou. Perez can be had for plus 160. Nicolaou was supposed to take on Manel Kopp in this spot. Manel Kopp, they were supposed to fight back in January. Manel Kopp, what, missed weight, and then the fight was basically scrapped. Then Manel Kopp pulls out of this one. It was supposed to be the rematch. And obviously that opportunity has passed by for him. Here's the thing, like any sort of Alex Perez fight is like, I always kind of worry about him at 125 on the scales. So it's like, if you liked Alex Perez, which I don't, I actually like Nicolaou here. I think he's just the more well-rounded. He just has the more well-rounded skill set. And he's a little bit better suited for a 5-round fight, I believe. But if you liked Perez, like, I don't know how you would bet him in advance here of that weight cut. Because we've seen him, even when he does make weight, sometimes looks super, super rough. He's the last guy on the scale. He's coming in on short notice for this. 125's never been too friendly to him. I think everything kind of points towards Nicolaou from a betting perspective. It's the flyweight division. We talk about it all the time. All these guys are super skilled in so many different facets of the game. You have to be. If you're 125 pound on, you know, on weigh-in day, if you're that size of guy, I mean, the NFL is not available to you. NBA is not available to you. Baseball, pretty much unavailable to you. All of the other main sports, it's like, that's why we get such great athletes at 125 pound. In general, it's just that there aren't many other you know, except for like, you know, maybe they could join the, you know, the Saftik family and become horse jockeys or something like that. There's not many sports out there for a male who's like 5'5", 140 pounds walking around weight. So yeah, all of these guys are incredibly skilled. They have not too many holes in their game. Outside of like somewhat of a shaky chin, I suppose, on Nicolau, I just like his entire skill set a little bit better. I think he's the rightful favorite at minus 185. The tricky part becomes if you want to chase props and stuff, maybe a Nicolau late wouldn't be too shocking, particularly if Perez has a bit of a tough weight cut. I don't know. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, much of the same. It's flyweight, so you know it's going to be competitive. Both guys are around the same age, got a not a similar skill set, but in many ways, if Perez can just keep this fight standing, use his wrestling to at least be counter-effective, Nicolau does his best work with his takedowns. Not even that he's a great wrestling threat, just he does his best work when he's on top. So if Perez just neutralizes Nicolau, Nicolau's a low-volume striker. Perez has turned out to be a pretty low-volume striker himself. Over five rounds, they're going to be mostly tightly contested. It's just up to the judges to get it right. So flyweight's always competitive, as you mentioned. And this one, it's not like one guy's a runaway winner. It's not like Nicolau dominates in one area. His wrestling's, again, not that much better than Perez's, if it's better at all. His jiu-jitsu, yeah, maybe slightly better than Perez's. But outside of like catching Perez in like a quick guillotine choke or something like Figueiredo did, like only the best guys in the world can do to him. If you don't catch him quick, like he's kind of the guy that's going to grind on you. So Perez's problem is, as you mentioned, has trouble making 125, right? Misses a bunch of fights, whether it's weight cut related, whether it's health issues, whether it's injuries. He just bails out of a ton of fights. So then finally he comes back versus Makhachev. And again, I picked him over Makhachev. Simple fact, he's a former title challenger. He's actually decent. He's had some bad run of luck in his career, but he's a solid individual and still been around the game for a long time. Still fairly young, not for flyweight, but young in general for the fight game, right? So goes into the Makhachev fight and honestly could have won that fight. Could have cashed a juicy ticket. Could have exposed Makhachev right then and there. But the third round, he's gassed, man. And he's so worried about the threat of the takedown that even though Makhachev is literally just sitting on his ass and half pulling guard, he's not throwing no punches. He's not letting his hands go. No trickery to him. It looked like a guy that was dealing with just like a ton of ring rust. Now, fine. That's what's going to happen when you have that much of a layoff. But coming into this fight, originally he's supposed to fight Tagir Ulyanbekov. Still a tough opponent, two wrestling styles, fair enough. But that fight's 6 weeks from now. So they say, oh shit, we need a guy to fight Matheus Nicolau because Cop's out. They pull in Perez, who literally is a company guy. You call him up, he's taking it. So they call him 6 weeks early and say, do you want to jump back in there? He's not going to say no. This is quite literally what the guy does. So he jumps in there. And as you mentioned, does that leave him a little bit ill-prepared? I probably think so. Five-round fight, he fights a grinding style, so if he doesn't got full gas in the tank, going to be a bit of a problem. And Nicolau, his problem is, again, he's low volume, but he seems to just, like, not conserve himself, but he's super efficient with his energy. There's no reason to believe that he's getting super tired. His fight with Tim Elliott, it's getting greasy, but he's the one that pulls through in the third round, scores the takedown, gets the top control. James Krause gave Elliott some bad advice in that fight. Regardless whether it was a fix or not, yeah, I think Nicolau over a five-round fight, good. Now, last but not least, you mentioned durability issues, and that's fair, but Perez is not a murderous power puncher. No. He's got a decent leg kick game, but outside of that, I don't see him like flash knocking out Nicolau, so it's probably a bit of a boxing match. Throw a couple takedowns in the mix. Maybe somebody gets a takedown. Maybe it's a quick get-up game from the other guy, but over the course of five rounds, yeah, just cleaner, more efficient work done by Matheus Nicolau, probably by a decision. But like you said, I would not be shocked in late stoppage, fourth or fifth round, if he can connect on something late when Perez is huffing and puffing. So Perez did look super tired his last time out, but he fought Makhachev, who fights a relentless pace. Nicolau doesn't. Nicolau's going to have to put the foot on the gas a little bit and hope to tire Perez out, because if not, it's just going to be a tightly contested flyweight fight. We're right back where we began. So, again, do you have a ton of faith in this fight? No. But who's the pick? Matheus Nicolau.
You're going to have a lot of faith in this next one, Cody. We got Ryan Spann taking on Bogdan Guskov. Minus 200 for Spann. Guskov can be had for plus 170. I mean, Spann's had some, like, Spann is a really tough guy to kind of know what to expect fight to fight. He's had some really brilliant performances. It all ends up being super violent, super high pace, super exciting most of the time. You go through, it's just a whole bunch of first round finish outside of the Anthony Smith loss, split decision loss last time out. And Guskov seems to hit really, really, really hard. The under 1.5 is juiced to minus 250, which is like pretty...
unheard of.
Pretty unheard of these days. Like 1.5 rounds is like, you know, 7.5 minutes. For it to be juiced to minus 250 is pretty crazy. So the books are all over that one. I mean, I kind of look at that total and I say, and I look at Span and, you know, where he struggled and so on and so forth. And I say, seems like a dog or pass type of spot for me. Goose can. That may actually
could be. Dude, he could be.
I don't think this guy's very good whatsoever. Yeah. But you're laying a plus 170. Him by knockout would be how I would probably see him getting the job done. If he were to get it done, is probably plus 200-ish, maybe more. That's where I would go if I was forced, you know, gun to my head, forced to make a bet on this fight. It's high variance, and I'm just going to take the plus money. Do I feel great about it? No. But I don't know if I'd feel great about laying Span just with his inconsistencies fight to fight.
Yeah, 100%, man. So I was pretty much at that same conclusion last night. Don't think I have the cojones to fully go Guskov because I just don't think he's any good. But there's 100 reasons to fade Span. And if you can get 2-1 on the underdog, value is certainly going to be there. So yeah, super talented. But again, he's never just been able to put it all together. His durability, a little bit in question. We remember back on the Contender Series when he fought Carl Roberson. He got knocked out in 15 seconds. Nasty elbows. 15-second knockout loss. And then his fight with... well, a couple of them, I guess, that he's been at least dropped in, hurt in. I don't think he's got the greatest chin on him. He doesn't got a great gas tank. He hasn't gone past the first round since 2020. So 4 years that he hasn't gone past the first round. And then as you will remember, because it was the sweat of a lifetime, but the last time he did go past the first round was the Sam Alvey fight. And he's a 4-1 favorite, over Sam Alvey. He styles on Alvey in the first round. Second round, he's gas. Third round, he loses. And he should have won a 29-28 across the board, but judges end up giving a split decision. So there's not a whole lot of instances where he's fighting a whole lot well past the first round. His best win, the Dominic Reyes fight. Reyes is shot to bits. It's a weird just power jab puts him over. And to be honest, he missed weight in that fight. So another guy that you got to watch the scales for because he's not good at cutting weight, especially to 205. He's a fairly big guy. If he looks like shit and you got a good plus money bet on Guskov, you're feeling pretty good about it. Super inconsistent, as Paul already mentioned, 50-50 type guy. So the fact that he's a minus 200 in itself, very worrisome. But that being said, the reason why I am just going to bite the chalk as I generally do in these shitty ass situations. Yeah, dude, he's fighting way better guys, man. Like Ryan Spann's losing. Sure. Two fight losing streak. Sure. A split decision with Anthony Smith, relatively competitive. I don't think he won, but one judge thought he won, and Smith's just a much more seasoned former title challenger, fought in a who's who of the division. You know, not a terrible fight. Prior to that, Nikita Krylov, a guy that's capable of hanging with some of the guys, best guys in the division. Dominic Reyes, arguably beat John Jones. Ion Cutelaba, decent little win there. Anthony Smith again, not sure why they fought twice. Guys like Misha Cherkinov, guys like Johnny Walker. So the talent level has been far superior for him. And yeah, he's losing in the first round from time to time, but at least he's hanging with some of the best guys. And as you mentioned, inconsistent, but capable when he's on of hanging with those best guys. When you look at Bogdan Guskov, it's much of the same in that all of his fights are done in the first round. It's just, who is he fighting? Some of them got some pretty looking records, but it's just really soft competition. So makes his own UFC debut against Volkan Oezdemir. Here's a guy that Ryan Spann's been... hasn't actually fought Volkan, but has fought in Volkan level of guys in pretty much all of his fights. And similar to Ryan Spann, he mails this one in, he gets rear naked choked in the first round. Volkan, not really known as a grappler, Volkan chokes him out in the first round. Not a great look, doesn't matter. Second fight against Pauga, he's getting doubled up on the significant strike counts. He's losing the fight to Zach Pauga, and then boom, he just intercepts him and folds him over. And this fight will be much of the same. Ryan Spann's just better than him. He's a better striker, he's faster than him, he's got a better ground game, he's got way more experience, he's better all around. But all Guskov's got to do is intercept him one time. Intercept him one time, put him on his heels. Once he's hurt, he generally gives it up. So if you're betting live underdog, guys with puncher's chances, guys with a path of victory, just Guskov being there. But he would have to be rock solid tough himself. He'd have to be one of these guys that can overcome a bad first round against Span and come back and win in the second or the third. And he's given no indication that he can do that. So I don't think Spann stands with him because he's not an idiot and he realizes the path of victory for Guskov is first round knockout. I think you see Spann shoot takedowns, which again, you don't see very often, but he's taken down way better guys than Guskov in the past. I think he looks to rely on that. He's got a nasty guillotine choke, maybe tries to take the back and get a rear naked choke. But in all scenarios, either guy's win conditions, as you said, the minus one, the under 1.5, that probably checks every box. But at minus 250, I would not do that on a personal level. I'm an over 1.5 guy. Under 1.5 at minus 250, like, no. Because all it takes is one guy to be heroic on that day and take a beating for 7.5 minutes and you're done. So I got to go with Spann. Again, he's just the better guy. Last thing I'll just sprinkle on, like the little tidbit, is that we seen Guskov at the PFL show the Friday before UFC 300. And he's listed 6'3", 76.5-inch reach by all means on paper. Big boy. Not that big in person. To me, anyways, didn't look that big in person. When you look him next to Anthony Smith, his you know, his likeness, Anthony Smith, Smith's much bigger guy. Smith's 6'4", don't get me wrong. Smith, much bigger guy. But keep in mind, Smith used to fight at 185. So Guskov's not a giant 205er murderous power puncher. He's a guy that's largely beaten up cans and happened to knock out Zach Pauga. Kind of falls in the category of can. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to him. He's just not had a good run as of late. So got to go with the more talented guy. It won't be high up on my list of things because I can smell the apple pie shit already. But yeah, I got to go with the more skillful guy to win the fight more often than not.
You wouldn't have said that to Bogdan Guskov's face. Be like, yeah, you're a little smaller than I thought, you know. And in fairness, we were sitting like three or four rows, like 4 or 5 rows up from him. All we really saw is his bald head. I bet you if we stood next to him, we would be like, that guy's huge and I'm terrified.
I've seen welterweights, that giant welterweights that was like, oh man, I don't know how you make 170. When you look at guys like 180, like Alex Pereira fought at 185 pounds, right? Anthony Smith, again, like I said, fought at 185 pounds. Those guys are way bigger than Bogdan. He can make 185. It's a 20-pound cut. Maybe he doesn't want to do it. That's fine. But Ryan Spann is struggling as shit to make 205. Guy walks around at 230, 235. So if the big old Ryan Spann gets that early takedown and grabs a hold of his neck, I think it's all she wrote. But they're both not untrustworthy. And then how could you feel confident laying down hard-earned money on it when you know just either guy has his night, he's the victor. Either guy comes in and mails it in, possible, the other guy wins. It's a tough fight to get a firm, I love this spot.
You guys should have heard the size shaming that Cody had when Puna Soriano was walking by us, whispering in my ear, just like, that guy's a welterweight.
Listen, MMA is such a dirty game because it's not the damage that you take in the fight. It's the damage you take to get to the fight, which is cut the weight. And it's a weight bully game. Like, as much as you want to think, oh, man, skill wins outright, it does not. The bigger man wins more often than not. And there's great guys that have great theories, like Gunnar Nelson. You know, I'm just not going to cut weight. Gunnar Nelson's a super high-level BJJ black belt, right? A guy competed at the ADCCs. Guy beat Jeff Monson, a man twice his size and a legitimate BJJ black belt. Still not super washing over the hill at that time. Like, Gunnar Nelson could do it all. His karate, super high-level black belt. He was like Conor McGregor. Guy had it all. Guy refused to cut any weight. And so eventually he got to a point where you're taking on guys that are twice your size and you're not going to win. Win once in a while, sure, but not all the time and not the highest level. So even veterans, I'm moving up a weight class and they'll have that early success, but will they go on that long-term run? I don't know. I hope Max does, but if he doesn't, it'll be because the guys at 55 are too big. He's not even mentioned. He wants to go back to 55. He's like steadfast on go back to featherweight. Smart. So weight class is 100% means something. And 185 to 205 is such a big gap, the 20 pounds, that when you come from the regional scene where you've just been beating guys that are also not actually in that weight class, then you get away with it. But then when you come to the UFC, you take on Volkan Oezdemir, he big brothers you. That's kind of a problem. And then Zach Pauga, it's just no good. I don't know what to tell you. He was winning the fight, for the record. Go back and watch it. Like, he's winning. He just winning until he's not. And that might happen to Ryan Spann. But if it doesn't, he's going to win and I'll have him.
All right, we got Karina Silva taking on Ariane Lipski, minus 150 for Silva, plus 130 for Lipski. It's an interesting fight, just like from the fact that, I mean, if you look at the total, right, you got the money line is right in line with the under 2.5, Because what does Karina Silva do? She's an absolute 100% a specialist from what we've seen. She takes people down. She finds submissions. She has multiple different tricks in that hat. But the submission game has been on point for her. If she wins, it's probably by submission. Maybe, I guess, a ground and pound would be in play. But, like, if I were to bet Karina Silva, it's like I look out on the market right now, and her by submission is plus 225. I would much rather take what I think is, like, mostly her win condition here. I haven't seen enough from her in terms of her stand-up skills or anything like that to lead me to believe that, like, she can hang with the revitalized Arianne Lipsky that we've been seeing recently. If she is going to win, it's probably that submission prop. But I'm buying it. Like, since, you know, since my girl Ketchup Beating and Cab, like, kind of, like, shook something in her head back into play and was just like, oh, yeah, I'm a prospect. I'm supposed to be something here. All of the pieces have kind of came together for Arianna Lipsky, and I'm buying into the fact that it's like, one, she's never been subbed in her career. She has been knocked out, of course, but Silva hasn't really shown us that devastating power. Like, I mean, Cachoeira, it's like, if you want to go into the pocket and sling, she's probably going to beat you in that. Like, that was just really, really poor decision-making. But, like, since that fight, we've seen it fight in, fight out. She just seems to, like, finally be getting to that potential that they saw, you know, when she was in KSW over in Poland. Yeah, I think it's dogger pass pretty clearly here. Not because of the CF dot model or anything, but I just think that Arianne Lipsky is heading in the right direction now. Karina Silva has been on a nice run of submissions. If I were to, quote-unquote, like, hedge the position here, I would do it with Karina Silva by submission because I really think it's sub or bust for her. So that plus 225 would be, like, my second favorite bet, but I think Arianne Lipsky plus 130 is the play here. What about you?
Yeah, dude, I honestly agree with a ton of your points. I think I might go Lipsky myself as well. CF doll model, 100% Lipsky. Does she have a path to victory? Yes, definitely. But you're going to get a better price in the live betting market because if Lipsky wins, probably going to be avoid those early takedowns, avoid those early submission attempts, survive that first round, then allow the accumulation of the strikes to start to develop, win that second, win that third. What you're getting right now in Lipsky, good, but Karina Silva is going to be hot for 3 minutes. You'll get a much better price in the live betting market. Again, it's no disrespect to Karina Silva. She looks like a legitimate prospect. It's that these fights, she's like, I don't want to say it. It's like she's not really looking that good until, boom, she ends up on top of her opponent and chokes them out. Nasty submission game, no doubt about it. But her contender series fight against Yang Gui, she's getting outstruck 27-12, and she got taken down twice. Now, Gui's fighting at a pace that no human being could sustain, and her and self included. She ends up gassing. Silva grabs a submission. Great. But, like, she's getting outstruck. Doesn't look super comfortable. A little bit stiff. A little bit rigid. Takedown game, okay. But getting out muscled in that spot. UFC debut against Pauliana Batello. You watch this show. You know me. You know how little I think of Pauliana Batello. So, yeah, you submit her. It's not really the end-all, be-all. The next win, Ketlin Souza. Decent little submission. Quick takedown. Couple strikes. Grabs a submission. Maureen Moroz. Maureen Moroz, not exactly known for her takedown defense, but in that fight, Silva, her striking actually looked pretty decent. She scores a knockdown over Moroz, ends up getting her down. Once she's on the ground, grabs a submission. She can bang a little bit, like she got a little bit of power. I just don't see a whole lot of finesse. The volume, not necessarily there. The takedowns, you know, muscles her opponent on the ground and then grabs that quick submission. But I don't know if she's going to rinse and repeat 3-4 takedowns. I don't know if she's going to stick to that game plan. Very much, and you see this all the time in women's MMA, once those takedowns don't materialize, one fighter gets real tired. Then this fight divulges into, you know, a scrap standing. Both girls want it. Both girls are coming forward. But you're going to want the plus money side on Lipsky. Now, Lipsky's a career... It's career, like, 180, to be honest with you. And I don't know what happened here. You mentioned the Priscilla Cachoeira fight. Either one of two scenarios, okay? Scenario number one is that after she lost to Priscilla Cachoeira, she looked herself dead square in the mirror and was like, oh, my God, what are you doing with your life and career, and you need to get it back on track? Thing number two is that Cachoeira smacked her so bad in the head that she just lost all recollection that she was not doing good, she was not performing good, she had low... you know, self-esteem, this and that. She spent, like, 5 weeks at American Top Team before the Cachoeira fight, got knocked out, and then was like, I need to move full-time to American Top Team and try to do something. And that's what she did. You look at her run since she's gone full-time to American Top Team. She's cashed 3 straight underdog tickets, right? So the first fight with JJ Aldrich, she's a plus 280 underdog. She takes a clean decision. Her next fight with Melissa Gatto, she's a plus 190 underdog and won a tight decision against a very, very strong fighter, a very good fighter. And then her fight with Casey O'Neill, she's a plus 160 underdog again and cashes. So again, since going to American Top Team full-time, she's still only 30 years old. She's on a 3-fight winning streak, 3 straight dog cashes, all of which were good, plus 280, plus 190, plus 160. And then this is the other good stat. The JJ Aldrich fight, JJ Aldrich went 0 for 12 on takedowns against her, right? Mm-hmm. Melissa Gatto went 0 for 7 on takedowns, and Casey O'Neill went 0 for 2, right? So she stuffed like 19 or 20 straight takedown attempts over the last 3 fights. Now, are those girls as strong physically as Karine Silva? Yeah, maybe not. But I don't think that there's that much of a discrepancy saying that, oh, you know, she's not going to be able to stuff what Karine's got. She might be able to. If she does get taken down, that's fine. She got taken down by Gatto. Or she didn't get taken down by Gatto. Sorry, she got to some, you know, some tough positions on the ground with Gatto, a strong Brazilian jiu-jitsu player as well, and did fairly okay. So in my mind, she can do enough to keep this fight standing for 2-3 minutes of the round, stuff a few takedowns, make her work for it, and just allow that volume count to rack up. Allow those short little elbows to rack up. Allow those knees from the clinch to rack up, and hopefully have 2 of the 3 judges side with you based on damage more than control time and the odd submission attempts. So again, you're coming off UFC 300 with Charles Oliveira. How do you score those submission attempts? How close is the submission? Either the guy's tapping or he's not, right? And if he's not, well, then you're just holding his arm. You're just holding his neck. And if he is tapping, well, the fight's over. So it's hard to score that kind of stuff. Karine Silva is a straight-up submission player. Lipsky, minds her P's and Q's, she could be okay. And being an American Top Team full-time over this 3-fight winning streak, like, she's training with the creme de la creme, so she should be ready. If she was the favorite, I would not advise it at all. But yeah, plus money, plus 130. I see the CF dog model. I see the dogger pass situation. Needed some dogs on this card. I'll take Lipsky as well.
All right, we got Jonathan Deniz taking on Austin Lane. A minus 240 for Deniz, plus 200 for Lane. I don't think I could ever put my money on Austin Lane, Cody. I think when all is said and done, I know it's low-level heavyweights, and historically, you know, these would kind of be the spots, but it's like, I don't know, man. There has been nothing from this guy that has been awe-inspiring as far as I can see. I mean, the fight on Contender Series for him, like, the guy that they found, if they signed that guy, he would be on the Mount Rushmore of worst heavyweights in UFC history. I just don't see it, bro. It's got to be Deniz, just like, because I just think that Austin Lane is destined to be lose, 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 cut type of situation here. Deniz on Contender Series obviously had a bit of a, you know, pretty relatively easy path in. It was relatively content, but yeah, 2 knockdowns. I guess significant strikes were pretty competitive between the two of them. First round finish. Obviously, he's undefeated in his career. Has he fought anybody of Lane's potential? Maybe, maybe not. But yeah, Lane is just not a guy who's ever going to get my money. It's probably more of a pass for me, but for the purposes of the show, Deniz will be the pick. What about you?
Yeah, it's your classic low-level heavyweight banger. Both guys are going to be swinging. Whoever lands probably wins, but you would think Deniz is going to land first, lands more often, and likely gets the kill shot. It's no disrespect to Austin Lane. It's that he spent vast majority of his early childhood playing football. Guy's a good football player. Solid college player. Played in the NFL for a little bit, floated around, and then eventually gets released and picks up mixed martial arts as a second career. Fights the Contender Series the first time around against Greg Hardy, and it's billed as like NFL player versus NFL player. Both of them were green to MMA. Both of them were second career guys. And Greg Hardy, who ends up winning, never became of anything. Austin Lane stuck with it, but he's not the youngest guy going. By heavyweight standards, he's not old. But again, he's not some up-and-coming prospect. He's not learning at a super rapid rate. And other than quick athleticism, big one-shot power, got to get it done early, he's defensively not very sound, and he's got no ground game to fall back on. Now, Deniz does not have a ground game to fall back on himself, but he's just like a way more polished striker. As you mentioned, you know, has he fought anybody in MMA of Austin Lane's stature? Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. But as far as his kickboxing career goes, this guy was like one of the top guys in Brazil. He fought for Glory Kickboxing, Glory 2, Glory 4, Glory 7, 12, 18, 37, 42, like OG right from the beginning. He fought Daniel Guida, lost in an extension round to Daniel Guida when he was 21 years old. Fought Rico Verhoeven, the great 10-year champion. Fought Verhoeven to a decision when he was 21 years old. So as far as kickboxing goes, the guy like did pretty much everything he could, switches over to MMA. It's not really a second career. He already knows how to fight. And he's applying that. So, like, yeah, does he have to work on his ground game? No doubt about it. But you're seeing a lot of these guys from Lion Fight or Glory or, again, just like the wrestling scene, the BJJ scene, you get to a certain point where you're like, I've done tons, but I'm not really getting paid. Transitioning over to MMA, but at least you have a base. So could Lane win this fight? Yes, because we've seen guys like Gokhan Saki lose. But at least he lost to Khalil Roundtree, a real fighter. Austin Lane is a real fighter. Good athlete, real fighter. It just he's further behind that learning block than a guy like Deniz, who's much younger than him, already has a nasty striking game, won on the Contender Series against, yeah, soft competition, but looked spectacular doing it. Two clean knockdowns, eventually puts him away. I just think that he's faster, sharper, more tactical guy. Could Lane throw a wrench in the plan and try to muscle up a takedown? Sure, but that's not who he is. So how is he going to suddenly just do that? And if he does do that, to what success does he have with it? Not entirely sure. I would think more often than not, maybe he gets muscles up a takedown. Deniz at some point is grappling with a not a great grappler, returns to his feet. And when he does land the kill shot then. So I almost feel like I have to be a little more confident on Deniz this week, because in comparison to a bunch of the other guys on the card, I'd like him. I think he wins. I think he would be one of the better spots on the card. But it's a dicey ass heavyweight fight. Two guys that, you know, are green in their own ways and still have a lot to prove. So how much do you love it? Can't love it that much. But on this card, yeah, it would be, to me, considered one of the much better plays. So I do have Deniz.
All right, we got Jonathan Pierce taking on David Onama. Jonathan Pierce, a minus 175 favorite. Onama can be had for plus 150. Probably one of the more interesting, you know, bangers, I suppose, on the card. And it comes down to, you know, Pierce, great grappler, is going to be shooting from probably the opening bell to whenever the fight gets finished for those takedowns. And Onama is super long, lean, but the takedown defense is a little bit questionable. Both interesting prospects in the featherweight division. I'm kind of tempted to take Onama as a underdog here. I don't love the takedown defense, don't get me wrong, but we've seen time and time again now, Cody, that if you're not getting like ground and pound from top position, if that opponent can get back to their feet, and that's, I guess, the big if with David Onama. It's like, if he's getting taken down, is he just getting ridden out from top control from Pierce? That's definitely 100% in play. Could he fall into a submission? Not out of the question whatsoever. So those are the risks you take, but if he gets up, lands some half decent strikes, he's got crazy, crazy reach and probably probably a pretty significant advantage in the striking department in this matchup. We've seen over time and time again now the way that, you know, judges are scoring fights, they're scoring on damage. So it's like those takedowns, holding position, control time really doesn't mean all that much. So at the current price, because it's a plus 150 underdog, I'm seeing this closer to like almost like a 50-50 type of situation. I'll go with Onama. What about you?
Yeah, tempted to take Onama. Don't think I'm going to get there. But I see everything you're saying again. I agree with the points. Onama is the better athlete. He's faster. He's sharper. He's a much better striker. And this fight is likely going 15 minutes. Even though Pierce is a grinding, top pressure type guy, he's not necessarily the biggest finisher. And then so in being that, you know, the first minute of the round is going to be standing. The last 30 seconds of the round could be standing. The second round's going to start standing. There'll be pockets for Onama to operate in. Pierce got knocked out by Joe Lauzon, which will always be that kind of stain on him. But I go back to the Christian Rodriguez fight, aged very beautifully that win. But he's taking on a kid that's just debuting in the UFC on ultra short notice. in a bad spot. Pierce is a giant favorite over him. Pierce dominates the first two rounds and then just flat gasses. And when he gasses, his hands are low, his head doesn't move off the center line, and he's there for the torching. If you got decent cardio and you can carry power, you're going to be a problem. Onama's got decent cardio. He's a super sharp striker. He does carry his power fairly decent. So he'll have opportunities to chin check Pierce. Could be a problem. Second thing, like you're saying, is that Pierce is getting these takedowns and he's fishing for submission attempts. He's trying to advance position, but there's not a ton of ground and pound. So all you need is a couple bad judges to say, well, Onama had him rocked, or oh, Onama was rallying and landing some good strikes. And then you got 2.5 minutes of top control from Pierce. But Pierce coming off the Joannes and Brito fight, like he just fought a guy that's so unbelievably dangerous with his stand-up, and he finds ways to just take these guys down and dominate them. He just made a bonehead decision of talking some trash and getting caught in a ninja choke. So I'm sure that's an embarrassing moment. I'm sure it's a go back to the drawing board and refocus type thing. But there's no doubt about it, man, that this guy chain wrestles. He's got good top pressure. And even though he's not scoring a whole lot of significant strikes, it's fairly clear he's winning the rounds because he's just he's all over them. It's unlike some other guys that we've seen, maybe Isaac Dalgarian, right? Where it's like he's getting the takedown and then just holding that one position. It's like Pierce getting the takedown, improving position, trying to open up, trying to find submissions. He's just not racking up a ton of damage. Fights with a decent pace, he's going to be able to get takedowns on Onama and really just lean on him. And then to me, that's where Onama breaks, is that if you look at his fights for the most part, I guess we'll just look at the last two. Nate Landwehr, quick start. The more that the fight goes is that he tires. Pierce, in many ways, fights just like Nate Landwehr. They've got that dog in them. They'll go toe-to-toe. They'll swing it out. They both come from the exact same regional scene over in Tennessee. They're Tennessee tough. And being able to get those takedowns, the later the fight goes, Nate Landwehr gets 3 takedowns on him. He gets 5 minutes of top control. That shouldn't have happened. And, I mean, Pierce is just... Nate can bang it out. Nate's got multiple skills, but I wouldn't say grappling and takedowns is his number one thing. Whereas Pierce, that's it. He's more of a perfectionist. He's very good at one thing, not great at a whole lot. If Nate Landwehr is taking you down, controlling you, I'm thinking Pierce is going to do the same thing. His very next fight, he takes on, and it was a good fight for him, but the Gabriel Santos fight, he gives up 2 quick takedowns. He gives up 90 seconds of top control. Eventually, he's able to sweep. Eventually, he's able to get back up. Eventually, he's able to find the finish. But Gabriel Santos is nowhere near the level of Nate Landwehr, let alone near the level of John St. Pierre. So I think the takedowns materialize. I think the ground game materializes. I think for 2 of the 3 rounds, he just wins. And then the 3rd round, he might have to hold on, but he likely does. I know it's like, you should just pull the trigger on some more of these underdogs. But, like, I'm not just looking to get a plus money guy just for the sake of plus money. I'd rather parlay 2 guys together and get plus money or chase a prop and get plus money. But I'm not looking to force a spot. I got to go with what my head and my gut tell me who's going to win more often than not. We got one crack at it. More often than not, the wrestling, the pace, the takedowns, it's the apex. It's a small-ass setting. There's no live crowd. Your coaches are right there. There's no giant adrenaline dump. You can just rinse and repeat on these takedowns all day long. There's small acoustics, so small little ground-and-pound punches are going to sound a lot better. And if the other guy's lost 4 minutes of the round, gets back up to his feet, lands a big knee, there isn't some giant commotion that's going to cause the judges to be like, oh, shit, that meant more than it did. So get it right more often than not, and that should be JSP. So... sign me up with St. Pierce to get the, I would think, a narrow-ish type decision. Let's get her done.
JSP, St. Pierce. High praise from Cody Savdic. All right, we got Uros Medic taking on Tim, the Dirty Bird Means. Medic, a -310 favorite. Means can be had for +260. Who you got here, buddy?
This is your another classic, absolute, just greasy fight because Uros Medic is the obvious choice. Why? He's younger. He's got a little more gas in the tank at this stage of his career. You know it's going to be a banger. But Medic has probably got a few more bangers left in him, whereas the Dirty Bird, maybe he's had one too many. But again, if you want to look at skill and who the more skilled guy is, it's Tim Means by a long shot. So with Uros Medic, he's just never turned the corner. 30 years old, not young, not old, but comes from the Alaska FC scene, and those guys typically don't get over a whole lot. He did the right things. He left Alaska, moved to California, got at Kings MMA, Master Rafael Cordero, whole group of guys down there, Benil Darius, Kelvin Gastelum, you name it. And he's gotten better, but who he is at his prototypical form is just a one-dimensional banger, man. Head up in the air, bang it out. His fight with Jalen Turner, pretty much all of them really have just been either he wants it more, comes forward, beats you up, Brandon Jenkins style, or skill's going to win outright. Again, just from his UFC fight, so the Alon Cruz fight, fly knee, pretty dope. Jalen Turner, who's got actual skill, takes him down one time and mauls on him. Omar Morales, they basically just stared at each other. It was a low-volume fight, but Medich has big power. If you're not going to out-volume him, you're not going to take him down. You're going to stand in front of him, have a low-volume, striking-type affair. His bigger punches will mean something. So a win over Morales, knocked him out. Fight with Matthew Semelsberger, he knocks him out. Doesn't look good until the knockout. Gets rocked himself prior. Then he knocks out Matthew Semelsberger. You've got a guy now in Medich, coming from a low-level regional scene, who's been operating at a fairly low level in the UFC. Wins, sure, but killed by Jalen Turner. Almost knocked out by Matthew Semelsberger. His next fight, which is his loss, with the Ortolani fight, again, he just doesn't really have much of a takedown game. Like, he gives up 7 takedowns to Ortolani. Doesn't have a real answer for it. There's a possibility that maybe Medich is just going to outlast him and have a puncher's chance, Homer Simpson type effect, but he doesn't, and he ends up getting neck cranked. The guy's wily. The guy's got heart for days. The guy's willing to throw down, but he just doesn't have the most skill going. So when you offer him for minus 300, that is the problem. Not that I don't think he wins more often than not. Not that. It's a minus 300. It's like, now we got to play percentages. And how good would you feel about him winning at that percentage? That I don't know. Because again, with Tim Means, he's coming off a win over Andre Fiallo, who's a banger as well. Trains out a good camp as well. He's quick, you know, has way more experience than Euros Medich. Decent win to come off of. His fight with Alex Moreno, he was super competitive in that fight till he got submitted. His fight with Max Griffin, super competitive. Argument he won, split decision loss. His fight with Kevin Holland. Kevin Holland's one of the top 10 guys in the division. So Means has always fought in better guys than Medich. His striking is way cleaner. His body work is nasty. He's got a beautiful straight left. He hits Medich clean on the chin. Semelsberger had him rocked like that. I think he puts him away. Means has got an opportunistic submission game in that he's going to have to hit you and hurt you and then grab the submission. He's not going to set it up clean up on the ground.
No.
Again, he's a savvy veteran. He's got things that you could like about him. It's just he's had 50 pro fights, and he's had just all so much wear and tear that bottom line is if they both stand and they bang it out, Means at his best kills him. Mean 3, 4, 5 years ago probably beats him. Mean now, he might only have a round and a half in him. And like Medich might have 2 rounds in him, that being the difference maker. So like if you were telling me I'm the odds maker, who are you going to set as the favorite? Well, obviously that's your pick. Whoever you set as a favorite is who you deep down is picking. I think Medich is the favorite. I think Medich wins. But at this line, he's not a good fighter. You're fading Tim Means more than you're betting Medich, and that's a bad idea because he's got something. Maybe he's got enough left in the tank to pull one off. He could hurt him. He could just something could happen to wash your ticket away. So I don't think I'm gonna pick Means straight up, but like at minus 300, you'd expect Medich to be on like the first or second line, and he ain't gonna be. No chance.
Yeah, I mean, Means is obviously much more experienced fighter. He's been in there with some very, very quality opponents. You know, never really got to, like, the top tier by any stretch of the imagination. And obviously, he's a little bit long in the tooth at this point. But yeah, I'm in a total agreement. It's a clear dog or pass type of situation. And on top of that, there may be, like, a bit of a different path to victory that we're not even really thinking of is, I mean, against Alex Perrone, Tim Means got 2 takedowns there. He did get caught in a guillotine choke, which is not exactly a great look. The cardio has always been a bit of a question mark.
That would be my problem, yeah.
Max Griffin, he got got 3 takedowns there. Kevin Holland, he got 2 takedowns. It's like, Medich, obviously, you know, taking on Oral Beck, whatever, Ty, or whatever. I can't pronounce that guy's name, but you know who I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
He obviously got taken down 7 times there. A lot of his other opponents, I mean, Jalen Turner doesn't really wrestle at all. He was able to, you know,
tell me about
he was able to take him down. So it's like, if I'm in Tim Means' corner, I'm saying, let's not even go too crazy. Like, this guy's power is going to be way less dangerous in round 2 and round 3. Let's just get top control, hold position, conserve our energy from top position, mix in some ground. That may just be taking Tim Means way too out of, you know, his element and what the Dirty Bird is all about. But the grappling advantage could be a real difference maker here. And you give him plus 260, against somebody who's really hasn't shown that he's able to stuff any takedowns from really anybody so far that's even tried. Yeah, it's pretty clear Dogger pass here. Means could beat him on volume too in a striking match. There's massive risk. He could get it. Means could get his head knocked off in the first minute. And, you know, people would be like, you guys are such idiots. I can't believe you didn't see that. Like, it's a fight. People are stripping down to their underwear and fighting in front of people for money. Like, it crazy things are going to happen. But yeah, no, at this price, no, there's no way I can get to Medic. It's Dogger pass, Tim Means for me as well. We got Victor Henry taking on Rani Yahya. Victor Henry is a minus 400 favorite. Yahya can be had for plus 300. A little bit of steam came in on Rani Yahya. He was like plus 475 yesterday. I don't hate the play that people took there. I was thinking about Rani Yahya, not because I really like him, but I'm just like, he's made a career out of like being very, very low volume on the feet, but like, somehow like, having half decent wrestling, being persistent in knowing what he is good at, and just kind of like making like dragging fights out, right? It's like that would really be his only path. Plus 475, I was considering once that number moved, now that it's moved out to like plus 300. Well, I mean, I see all of the advantages. You know, if Rani Yahya is not able to get this fight to the mat, he's going to be like quadrupled up. Quintupled up on significant strikes. It's not going to be even relatively close. Rani Yahya, his durability used to be one of the things that you're like, well, he kind of just hangs around and does like the backflop and stuff, but he hangs around because his chin's able to get it. Now you start to question like whether that durability is there. I think at the current price, it's probably pretty accurate here, and I think Victor Henry, rifle fave. Obviously, I was always going to favor him. But after that market move, I was just like, it's a straight up pass from a betting perspective. Victor Henry is obviously the play for me. I imagine he's going to be pretty high up your PRP this week.
Okay, so this is how bad this card is from a betting perspective. Victor Henry is undoubtedly the best play on the card. But yeah, he's the line. The line is awful.
Well, it's gotten better for you.
It has gotten way better for me. And I said the simple fact is that Rani Yahya, for as bad as he is, for as limited as he is, for as one-dimensional as he is, the guy knows how to win based on doing virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. His ground game is superior to everybody's. I get it. But it's tricky, man. They'll broadcasters will tell you. They'll tell you 100 times, a big former ADCC champion. 2003, Paul. He won the ADCCs in 2003. It's 21 years ago. If his medal was a person, it could drink in all 50 states. It could go serve the country, come back, have a kid, and it wouldn't look out of place. Like this guy's been around the block, has the grappling, sure, but zero wrestling, zero striking, just grappling. And very much like Claudio Silva. I shit on Claudio Silva all the time when he used to fight back in the day. Guy has a win over Leon Edwards. Crazy. Beat Leon Edwards. And is yet one of the most god-awful fighters that you will ever see in your lifetime. But they're such specialists in their one dimension. They're capable of winning, man. They're capable of winning by just not even getting the takedown, but sometimes pulling guard, sometimes hitting a quick sweep, sometimes just diving on a leg, and then all of a sudden you fall over for a second, they attack a leg lock, then they'll use that leg lock to end up on top, and then you're screwed. And those situations happen with Rani Yahya his entire career. The guy, honestly, again, I know it sounds like disrespect, but Rani Yahya is terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible. And yet he'd be rocking a 13-5 record in the UFC over a decade. Fights once a year. Used to fight twice a year. Always fought twice a year. Now he fights once a year at best. I was shocked he's still on the roster. He's 40 years old. He'd be rocking a 13-5 UFC record. So yeah, I've lost a ton of money betting against him. Every time I've lost money betting against him, I didn't feel bad about it. Not like, ah, man, I should have bet Ronnie that time. It was like, God damn it. One stupid move is a difference maker in a bunch of these fights. Just like Claudio's. The thing with Victor Henry as well is that even though he's got that catch can wrestling, Josh Barnett, BJJ black belt himself, solid grappler, is that he has been taken down in a couple of his UFC fights and his get up game ain't great. He got taken down twice by Rafael Assuncao, gave up like 6 minutes of top control. He got taken down 3 times by Tony Gravely, gave up like 4 minutes of top control. And then his last fight with Javi Bashrod, he got taken down. Overall, 78% takedown defense because he's stuffing a ton of takedowns. But when they do get that top control, His ability to just flash scramble back up ain't there. He's a little bit older himself. He spent probably his best years were fighting the best guys in Japan. But now that he's fighting in the UFC, he's considered a little long in the tooth, especially by the division standard. It's a young man's game. It's all speed. So Henry's not an end-all be-all. He's not someone that you love so much is that he's better than Ronnie Yaya. If Ronnie can pull guard, if Ronnie can attack a leg, if Ronnie can find some way, just like the Masahari Kanahara fight from back in the day, Masanori Kanahara fight, just like lose the entire fight and then somehow fall on a position or two and win, because that's what Ronnie does. So I see a world, I see ways that Ronnie could win this fight if he can get his hands on him, if he can take him down, and if he can neutralize him. But coming off a year-long layoff, having fought once in the last 2 years, twice in the last 3 years, being nearly 40 years old, not ever having a good striking skill set or a good wrestling skill set, so what are we expecting? This guy just going to come off the shelf and he's going to win? Like, I don't know about all that, man. To Henry's credit, at least he's competing. And Rowney Barcelos, Rafael Assuncao, Tony Gravely, Javid Basharat.
Good opponents.
Yeah, all good guys. All good guys. So he's staying active, fighting relevant guys who are relevant within the division, which means something. Ronnie not there, man. Ronnie's not there by a bunch. And Ronnie, it's like, oh, man, what's his takedown accuracy? 32%. And then even better, his takedown defense is 24% because he just flops. He'll just flop. He'll grab a hold of you, and if you shuck him off, he'll just flop to the ground. And that's fine when you're the best BJJ guy in the world, but it's 2024. You don't want to be playing guard. You don't want to be hanging on your back the entire time. And Victor Henry's not an idiot. You know, he's a savvy veteran who's fought in some of the best guys in the world, who knows how to grapple, who's out of a grappling-centric team. He might not be worried about just sitting on top of Ronnie and playing. Maybe, hopefully not in the guard, but, you know, play a half-guard type game. Land a few short punches. Box him up, box him up, box him up. 90 seconds left, minute left. Fall him to the ground, punch him in the face a few times. So, yeah, Victor Henry, again, I think he's one of the best favorites, if not the best favorite on the entire card. So my proposition is I put him on the top ticket, which doesn't even add a ton of value because his line's out of whack, and it's still a greasy fight at the end of the day. That's where I'm at this week. So smart bankroll management is just like, get out of this week. Bet on the BKFC card. Some nasty spots on there. There's LFA on the Friday. If you want to really get greasy, there's some nasty lines on that Centurion MMA if you got on them before they got ballooned up. Doesn't matter. It's a combat sports weekend. Roncesvalles Bartholomew's fighting Friday. There's dope boxing on. Just, you don't really have to bet every fight on this 13-fight UFC card just to have some action. So, yeah, I'm going to have Victor Henry because I do not like Ronnie Yaya. I don't know if I made that clear or not. I'm betting Victor Henry. I would bet pretty much any human being in the UFC opposite Ronnie Yaya. But he's 13-5. He wins at 2 times the rate that he loses. Buyer beware, Paul. Buyer beware. There's probably smarter spots elsewhere on the weekend.
Hey, I mean, Ronnie hasn't submitted anybody that actually currently still has. I was just looking through his record. He hasn't submitted anybody that actually has a spot on the roster in ever. Nobody that he's actually submitted still has a spot on the roster. You know, he got 3 takedowns and lost by decision, only had 1 submission attempt against Kung Ho Kang. So it's like he was able to get takedowns, but wasn't able to hold
position. Kung Ho Kang
is good.
Kang's the only guy that he's won that is still on the roster.
Exactly.
Like every single
Ray Rodriguez, he got the submission, but like gone. Like was never really. He was like in and out, like the Abe Simpson meme. You know, like put the hat on the shelf and then whoop, you're back out again. Luke Sanders, oh my God, the PTSD that we have from Cool Hand Luke Sanders on this very podcast.
I met him in Nashville a few months ago, and he's so unbelievably cool in real life. Small little guy, so cool in real life. But like even though I was like, oh, it's Luke Sanders, hey, like I couldn't even look him in the eye, man. I couldn't even look him in the eyes. Like, dude, you've looked me down so many times.
You cost me so much money, but you're so nice.
Yeah. I'm your biggest fan, and you've cost me so much money. I've met my own fans in real life. They sometimes tell me that. all jokes aside, it's like Cool Hand Luke's the man. But just if you're looking for one fight to tape study that you don't have to look at the 20 fights that Ronnie Yaya's had in the UFC, you'll remember this one, the Ricky Simone fight, where Ricky Simone was like, I'm not going to fall you to the ground, and you sure as shit ain't taking me down. So he would just pop him in the face, sprawl him, sit in the guard for like 2 seconds, pop him in the face, and just disengage and wave him back up. It's a brutal fight to watch. It's the perfect game plan. And I think Victor Henry, not Ricky Simone type of power wrestling, but in many ways can mimic the exact same thing.
Yep. All right, we got Michael Figlak taking on Austin Hubbard, minus 170 for Figlak, plus 150 for Hubbard. Figlak obviously came into the organization about a year and a half ago now. And we were both like we watched, you know, the tape on the regional scene, and I was like, I like his like pressure style. I think he's got multiple components to his game. And we picked him, and he cost us quite a bit of money that week. Fair as I am. You know, wasn't looking that impressive at the time. He's coming off of, you know, the quick loss against Terrence McKinney, and you know, he just hadn't had that great of a run. That loss has aged a little bit better. Figlak's still young, and I feel like probably, you know, putting in time with a half-decent gym over in the UK, I feel like we're going to see a lot of improvements. It's a lot of, like, hoping, wishing, and all of that. I know he trains with, like, Jai Herbert, who, you know, he trains with Jai Herbert and that crew. I forget the name of the gym. But either way, I'm expecting to see the guy that we kind of saw on tape coming out here. The market kind of agrees with me. It was like minus 150 yesterday. Now it's minus 170. Austin Hubbard, outside of beating my boy, Max Roshkoff, hasn't really done anything. He hasn't really ever done too much at the UFC level here. I'm expecting a much better performance from Figlak. So sign me up for the minus 170 favorite here. What about you?
Yeah, it's so much if, and I'm not sure why, but I'm buying into it as well. And I have Figlak, and I hit him at minus 150, minus 153. So it's nice that the market's moving in that direction. People agree. But we're all just saying if. The Figlak on tape, fighting for Cage Warriors, man, this guy is just barn on fire. He can do it all. Generalist, like he's not, this guy's a great striker, this guy's a great wrestler, this guy's a great grappler. You could do it all, can do it all pretty decent. And cardio for days, durability for days. 27 years old, this guy's going to be a legitimate prospect in the UFC. I like him. Faraz Aham had been cut from the UFC. They just brought him back. I think they were in Paris. They needed a body. They're like, you're somewhat of a local guy. He's not on a great run at the time. It turns out Zayam's pretty good himself. But at that time, he just wasn't expected to quite be there. Figlak was a big favorite. I bought into the hype. Because again, it's not just you buy into what everybody else thinks, the undefeated record, the hype, so to speak. You watch tape on him. He's my kind of guy. He doesn't take his foot off the gas. He's constantly coming forward. He's constantly combination punching. He's got nice technique, solid technique. Still young in his career. Still green in some spots. But a good prospect. Solid guy. And then he just did not show up at Zayem at all. He gave up 3 takedowns to the French Muay Thai fighter. His volume was gone. He was hurt. He was tired. And like back in the day, Joe Rogan and Mike Goldberg would say it every time a guy debuted, but they weren't wrong. It's like UFC jitters. And I almost wonder, like that's something we never talk about anymore because quite literally half the cards making their debut on every single card. So many fights. Even when you're in the apex, is like what kind of jitters do you really feel? But it's a real thing, man. It's a real thing that he's undefeated in Europe and kicking ass against European competition, comes over, takes on a guy that's had 3-4 fights in the UFC, guys that have fought, and you know, Zayem had fought Jamie Mullarkey. He had fought, you know, a decent level of competition. You know, the loss aged well because Zayem's really not all that bad, but it's not crazy to think that the moment got to him. He didn't have a great weight cut. He traveled all the way state, and he wasn't even stateside, I guess, so I don't know what would have affected him. But still, just leaving your comfort area, fighting for a new organization, having that spotlight on you, being a big favorite, having the expectation of being undefeated and performing, again, maybe it got to him. So they did book him one more fight after he lost to Zayem, and he got hurt. He pulled out. But since that fight, yeah, it's been like 16 months if we've seen him. He's still super young. I don't think he's all banged up. He's probably healed his injuries, if anything. But that time off, I think, would be great for him just to add to his skill set, get that confidence back going, get hungry again, get chomping at the bit, come back into the UFC, reintroduce yourself. Already had that first experience out of the way. Come back with a solid sophomore outing. The line's not terrible. Well, minus 170, you're starting to get into some dirty territory. But yeah, it wasn't terrible to take that shot and fake like that, he will come back improved. Hubbard, it's more that just like he's a warm body. Again, he's not someone that does anything that great. The worry to me, though, if you're just looking to straight up fade him and put a ton of money on Figlak, on the proposition that he's made these improvements, is that Hubbard's actually got a legitimate takedown game. It doesn't really seem to, you know, catch anybody's radar, but he's rocking, I guess it's like only a 52%. In his last three fights, he took down Dakota Bush. He took down Vince Bichelle four times, which ain't easy, man. Vince Bichelle is an absolute stump of a man with very, very big strength. You know Vince Bichelle. Nobody's got to explain it to Paul.
Nope.
Four takedowns over Bichelle. Two takedowns over Kurt Holaba, who, again, comes from a wrestling background, is a pretty decent grappler. Lost to Vince Bichelle in a close fight. Got submitted by a Kurt Holaba triangle choke. Holaba a black belt, for the record. But against Figlak, like, he just got taken down the last time we saw him by Faraz Zayam. He got outgrappled by Zayam. He's going to get outgrappled by Austin Hubbard on paper from what we can see right now. And Hubbard training at altitude is a guy that can probably do it for 5, 10, 15 minutes. The way he beat your boy Max Roshkoff was simply Homer Simpsoning him. And then coming on in the second and the third round, I didn't go to a third round, but coming on late because he does got decent cardio. Can a guy like, can a high level guy, a high level grappler, a Kurt Holaba catch him with a triangle? Sure, but Figlak's not high level jiu-jitsu. I don't think he's gonna sub him off his back. If he doesn't stuff the takedowns, he's gonna be wearing Hubbard like a blanket for a couple rounds. It's not good. It's not good. And again, he's not a huge power puncher. He's a volume puncher, mm-hmm. a combination puncher. So you don't want to be chasing a third round knockout when it's like he's going to have to just empty the tank and put a beating on Hubbard because he's down two. Like, there's things that worry me. Hubbard wrestling heavy, which should be the path of victory for him, and it should be the game plan for him. Don't tire out. Stick to this guy like glue. There's the path. And at plus money, there's the path. But again, the reason I bet Figlak yesterday, I'm buying into it. I really liked what he looked like prior to signing to the UFC. This guy's got the goods. What happened in his debut? Couldn't tell you. But we've seen this happen with guys before. It's like, he's not as good as everyone said he was. And then a few fights later, it's like, oh, shit. This guy's actually pretty good. Even sometimes guys win, but it's a flat-ass performance. And then the second time around, it's like, oh, man, that's what everyone was talking about. So Christian Rodriguez lost his debut. That Peyton Talbot, you know, looked, I don't want to say pedestrian, but he didn't look great in his debut. It's like, how do these young prospects continue to come back and make improvements? And Hubbard is not going to make any improvements. We know what he can do, but at 32 years old, this is it. This is him. It's going to be the same thing fight to fight. No new wrinkle. Whereas Figlak, there's still a ceiling there. So I'm on team Figlak. Will he let me down again? We'll have to find out Saturday. But like, you could see it happening for sure.
Yeah, it's been like 20 months since his UFC debut. We're ready to hurt again. That's what it's all about. That's it. All right, we got Kyle Machado taking on Dante Mays, minus 120 for Machado, plus 100 for Dante. Who you got?
Yeah, so this is one of those you should just pass, absolute pass, but I'm taking that shot on fading Kyle Machado. Oh, I do not care for Kyle Machado. Again, it could be pretty much any heavyweight in the heavyweight division. I would probably take a shot at. Yeah, that's fair. And like, maybe I just give him a bad rap. It's just like, he's from BC. I followed his entire career and I don't think he's good. I've never thought he's good. He's just extremely limited and he's never tested himself. The fight with Mick Parkin, that's a tough one because he's landing the damage, or he's landing the strikes, and Parkin, for whatever reason, just went to like a real wrestling heavy game plan, which Parkin doesn't really do, but mm-hmm. did. And just wrestled them down and didn't look good doing it. But I don't know. Again, he could have been sick. He could have. Remember when Conor McGregor pulled his hamstring against Max Holloway? And he's like, oh, I'll just take him down. It's like, it's unlike him. He didn't do that to anybody else. But it's like, I got to find a plan because I'm not right now. I don't know. Who knows what it was? His fight prior to that against that Kevin Skafalski. Man, that guy was absolutely fraudulent. And that's my problem with Kyle Machado. So here's a guy, only 29 years old, baby by heavyweight standards. Nice looking record. Comes from my own country of Canada. Would love to get behind this guy. Debuts against Jamie Smith. You know, run-of-the-mill Canadian bottom-of-the-barrel type heavyweight. Fights to a draw. Gassed out. Terrible fight. Ends up beating him in a rematch. Then loses to Dustin Johnson, who would be considered, by heavyweight Canadian standards, a good heavyweight. Loses to Johnson. After that, man, 0-0. 2-2. He fought Lee Mean, who's 11-14. Okay? Lee Mean, at the time, was 53 years old. Machado was 26. He's 26 years old. He fights a 53-year-old Lee Mean, and he wins. And he beats Chris Larson, and then the sumbitch rematches Lee Mean. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What would you gain from this? So
a dub.
I, the dub. Just pad up your record, not face any type of adversity, had your way up, and then eventually, with a nice, bright-looking record, the UFC is going to sign you, and they're going to say, okay, great. They're going to take you on for a ride. Okay, great. You're on the Contender Series. Maybe you win in the Contender Series. Maybe you're in the UFC. But how many times have we been seeing this? Guys get the contract. They come to the UFC. They're not ready for it. Or guys fight for the contract for the first time off a balloon 6-0, 7-0 regional show record, and they get smoked right out the gate. It happens all the time. That being that if you pad your record and then you try to fight some big boys, you're going to run into that talent gap. Now against Kevin Solfitsky, yeah, okay, the guy's no good. So he can win that one. And against Mick Parkin, it was a bad version of Mick Parkin that took him down three times. Somewhat competitive. At 29, no doubt he's getting better. At 29, no doubt his best fights are a few years down the road. I'm just not sold on him. And the fact that he avoided taking those tough fights, building his way up, again, is problematic to me. Dante Mays, meanwhile, 32 years old, not like he's anything special, but guy went 8-0 as an amateur, put his work in as an amateur, racked up an 8-0 record before turning pro, beat Harry Hunsucker, it's not good, but he's a UFC veteran in his pro debut. But Alan Crowder, Demario Dennis, Muhammad Usman, whom he beat, Michelle Sipe, who is on The Ultimate Fighter, whom he beat, this Ricardo Pressel on the Contender Series was 10-1 at the time, debuted in the UFC with Cyril Gane, fought in Rodrigo Nascimento. I don't know why he'd fought him twice, but fought him twice. Wins Salty, Roque Martinez, Josh Parisian, Andrei Arlovsky. What I'm saying, though, is like Mays has actually fought in good guys, and yet his takedown defense is not very good, but I don't think Machado's takedown defense is very good. Mays is long. He likes to work that jab. He likes to be a tricky switch stance type guy. He's been a training partner of John Jones's in Albuquerque for many years. There's some likeness to him. It's that if you take him down and just sit on top of him, crush his spirit, he's no good. And I don't think that Machado's that guy. He just got out grappled by Mick Parkin in all of his other fights. Again, he's not fighting anybody that would be remotely called a wrestler, let alone a grappler. Don't know how much I can like. Mays is also only 32, but he's got 10 fights in the UFC, right? So he's got way more experience. He's not super old by heavyweight standards. And if he shores up a few of those holes in his game, he can get on the winning track. It's a 50-50 fight. The odds got is a 50-50. I would trust more in the improvements of Mays and his willingness to test himself and that making him better as a fighter than taking the padded route. So as of right now, yeah, Mays has done the right things. 50-50, greasy fight, I get it, but I'm taking him.
It might be the return of D1 Dontale. He hasn't really shot a takedown in a while. But
he can.
We can. He's got like a massive reach advantage. Machado does have, I think, the striking advantage over him, definitely in terms of volume. I don't know. I'll flip the script and I'll take Machado here. Wins slightly on volume. But I'm not going to be stunned if he gets... I mean, he got taken down three times against Mick Parkin, who doesn't really wrestle whatsoever. I imagine Dontale's game plan here is just going to be lean on him, tire him out, get takedowns, hold top position. We'll see what he did, you know, when he... Which fight was it that he had like six takedowns in? It's been a while, but... Yeah, it was against Josh Parisian, where he like just took that game plan. Then he took on Handy Anal Swab and...
And cost me so much money. And
it cost
Andy's
everyone
on
money.
Steroids. And he's on steroids, and he'll never fight in UFC since, again. Yeah. But at least there's those moments where it's like, oh, he knocked out Arlovsky, which a lot of good guys haven't really been able to do, right? And as of late, everyone knows the story of him. You know, he put up the six takedowns against Josh Parisian. He landed 98 significant strikes against Sipe on the Contender Series. So for a heavyweight, there's been volume, there's been power, there's been some wrestling. It's just putting it all together. He's got bad ring IQ, and he's not putting it all together. The more you fight, the more you compete, even in a loss, you learn more about yourself as a martial artist. He's going to figure it out. Not to say his opponent won't. It's just he's at least gone through the trials and tribulations, and I like that a lot more.
Fair enough. All right, we got Ketlin Souza taking on Marnik Mann. Ketlin Souza is a minus 330 favorite. Mann can be half plus 275. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no real thoughts. I mean, I'll admit, I've been trying to focus on like a bunch of the other fights this weekend that this one's kind of half fallen through the cracks. So I'm not going to sit here and bullshit you on it. But yeah, it seems like you've got your classic. Ketlin Souza is bigger than her, stronger than her, got a better grappling game, is a minus 300 favorite. And it's a women's MMA fight that could probably be a lot closer than need be. When I look at Marnik Mann, her Contender Series fight against Bruna Brasil, she can wrestle. She's wily. She can get the fight to the ground. It's that she doesn't really establish top control all that well. She allows her opponents to get back up. She herself is getting taken down. There's something you can like to her, but then Bruna Brasil just absolutely folds her. folder, but absolutely blasts her with a kick. Pretty nasty work. Gets comes with the UFC regardless and takes on that Josefine Knutson, right? And Knutson's known Muay Thai, big, strong, physical. Like, Knutson took her down and just being way stronger in the clinch, way more physical with her. So when you look at Ketlyn Souza, who I don't rate, I don't think is all that good, I would think she's just going to be a little stronger, a little more physical, better grappling. They probably clinch up. It probably hits the ground. Man might end up on top for a few minutes. At some point, there's a scramble. At some point, there's a reversal. Someone hits a switch. It gets backed up standing, and all of a sudden, her opponent gets her down. When that happens, I feel like Souza opens her up with something. But yeah, I mean, again, is it going to be, I don't know. I don't know if you have a better lean on it than I do, but in like the limited tape that I was able to watch and from what we all know previously of both girls, it does seem like a Sousa, you know, fight for her to go get her first UFC win. But I'm not fully sold on this is a 3-1 favorite, deservedly so.
Yeah, no, I'm terrified of like going through her record and stuff like that. Like that. Lane, you know, minus 330, which is like a 75% win rate.
Yeah, it's a stretch.
Like, this is not some sort of, like, top-end prospect. But that being said, Martinik Mann is, like, pretty small. Like, how do these two girls stack up? She's 5 foot with a 64-inch reach. It's like, let's face it. You know, it's a strawweight division, but if there was an atomweight division, Martinik Mann could probably get herself into that division. The frame isn't that big. And Souza has fought at 125 pounds in some fights.
She fought at 135 pounds.
Yeah.
She fought at 135, then Invicta signed her. She fought at 125. She won the Invicta title over Christina Williams, who's gigantic. And then she came to the UFC and actually fought Karine Silva at 125 pounds. And then is dropping back down, or I don't even back down, but she's going down to 115. So again, I mean, we don't know what she looks like pre-flop. She's still going to make weigh-ins, but she's going to be much bigger, much stronger, much more physical, better grappler. And both girls will have probably moments of being on top. It's that when man's on top, there's not going to be a whole lot done. Mm-hmm. When Souza's on top, she's going to fish for a submission and likely grab it or flatten her out and ground and pound her, but likely make it count when you're arguably two weight classes up. So undersized fighter, giant fighter, and man can't turn down these opportunities. She lost on the Contender Series, still came to the UFC, lost at that as well, both times undersized, and now what's she going to do? Say no? She's gonna take it, which she is. So, but does that cause you to take Souza on your top ticket? No. Did you put it on Souza on the top second ticket? Maybe, but how embarrassing would you feel? Like, could you look at yourself in the mirror and feel good about that? Like, probably not. So you put her on the third ticket, you know, and then you watch man shit in the apple pie, some shit in the apple pie. I don't know. You sit at home and you think, why did I even get involved whatsoever? But Souza's the pick. I can't play contrarian just because you want to. You got to take who you think is going to win. I think Souza's going to win. I'd love to see the weigh-ins first just to ensure that and then figure out what to do with this line to improve it.
Because cutting down to 115 maybe could be potentially a problem for her. We'll see.
If she misses weight,
like Martinik Mann hasn't
hammer it. If she misses weight by half a pound, it'd be bad.
She doesn't show me anything to like what her best win is what against Amber Brown. Like that's what got her onto Contender Series, where she got absolutely flatlined by Josefine Knutson. That was like never competitive, basically, at any point in that fight. There doesn't really seem to be all that much there. She's probably undersized. The other girl's coming, took on somebody who's a submission specialist. At least she's taken on, you know, she took on Arianne Carnelosi way back and, you know, got into the third round against Carnelosi. I think Carnelosi would probably go out there and finish Martinik Mann in the first round. That girl's a tank. So I think it's a rightful favorite. Am I going to be excited about, you know, I'm sure she'll be on the PRP, I'll tail that. But, yeah, there's lots of other fights this weekend. Ketlyn Souza minus 330 is not something I'm, like, circling, being like, gotta add that to a whole bunch of things this week. But, yeah, she will be the pick as well. CF dot model is not going off for me on that one. We got James Lontop taking on Chris Padilla. Lontop, a minus 350 favorite. Padilla can be had for plus 280. This fight was added on Tuesday, I believe, so pretty late add to the card. Lontop was already on the card. Padilla, I mean, it just seems like a regional level banger that, you know, was happy, willing, able, and available to take a short notice fight. Lontop was supposed to be taking on Gabe Green in this spot.
Yeah, well, he's had two fights fall through.
Yeah, Gabe Green had an exciting fight on the Contender Series against Malik Lewis. I mean, -350. I mean, it opened up at like -200. It's been steamed up to -350. It's Contender Series, guys, but it all makes sense. Like, one guy showed some sort of promise. That, like, I don't. Did they give him the Contender Series spot, like, on the actual show? I can't really quite recall. But obviously, he ended up on a short list of, like, hey.
Yeah, Lontop did.
Yeah, okay. I mean, they gave everybody a contract last year, let's face it. But, yeah, I guess Lontop is the pick, but I'm not overly excited about where this line is and where it's going.
Yeah, no. Listen, James Lontop is another one of your good picks this week. He's the guy. The more money comes in on him, the more steam comes on him. It's just at that point you start getting to the value side of things and how much do you love a guy making his UFC debut fairly untested, 24 years old. Problems that could go wrong. But yeah, no, I like James Lontop. So again, here's a guy that comes from Peru. Love Peru. Peru's all altitude, the entire thing. It's very mountainous, right? At the highest points, woohoo, even at the lowest points, well above sea level. So these guys generally have great cardio. And you look at the vast majority of Peruvian fighters, they're very, very physically strong, and they can carry that. Lontop's the same. He's got tons of volume. He can carry over that cardio. Been a decision a pile of times, but got some late finishes, you know, second round knockout, third round knockout, decision. Again, someone that has pace, has pressure, has great cardio, still young, undefeated. Well, not undefeated, but he's on a 12 fight win streak. Gotta love it, right? That Malik Lewis fight. Now, Malik Lewis was the guy that fought Trevor Peak on the Contender Series. Mm-hmm. Malik Lewis absolutely beat the shit out of Trevor Peak for about, you know, 4.5 minutes, probably like right to the end of the first round, into the second round, done. And all of a sudden he's done. But Malik Lewis ain't bad. He was undefeated at the time. He gave Peak a go. He won one fight on the regional scene. They bring him back from the Contender Series, and James Lontop smoked him. He knocked him down twice, 74 significant strikes, gave up 2 takedowns. But again, solid get-up game, strong physical guy, causes you to work, puts hands on you, and eventually takes the unanimous decision. But there was something that you could like from Lontop, who, again, is green, 24. That would have been a career best payday for him. And now you expect to see a better version and a better version and a better version. The fight with Lando Venata is tricky because Lando Venata, even though washed, wrestled in college, you know, guy fought Tony Ferguson, fought some high-level guys back in his day, is squirrely, is wily, trains out of Albuquerque with a good cast of characters, just a wily veteran. I think Lontop wins that because he's got that come-forward pressure style, the strength, the athleticism, the youthfulness. But it's a tricky fight against Lando Venata. Venata out, you get Gabe Green. Gabe Green is junkyard dog rugged, going to come after you, going to bite down his mouth shield, and going to throw down for you. Completely different matchup, but it's still a solid enough guy. Gatekeeper, journeyman, 50-50 record. I get it. But Gabe Green's still a tough outing. Chris Padilla is the worst of the three guys. In fact, he's worse than Malik Lewis. So, like, I think Lontop lands his shots. He probably knocks him out. If he doesn't knock him out, he's just going to put pace and volume on him for 2 rounds. And then if he has to skirt by the third, sure. If not, you're going to win that too. Take a 30-27. Padilla, it's not like he hasn't fought in nobodies. But
coming
his
off
times
of
that he's
against Justin James, yep.
Yeah, and I mean, like, he fought Jason Gonzalez back in 2016, lost, right? He fought Christian Aguilera back in 2016, and he lost. He fought Gabe Green back in 2018 in a Bellator fight and lost. He fought Nate Andrews in 2018 and lost. So that's 3 UFC veterans and a PFL veteran. Those are his 4 step-up fights, and he lost all 4 of them. Yeah, Devin Brock. Devin Brock's okay. I think he's like 11-7 now, 6-4 at then, and he loses that one. Darren Smith Jr., Hollywood, right? Longtime jet veteran. Give him a good go, but ultimately, step up fight, and he loses. EL Porti's terrible. The Sarab Manashian guy, no good. Justin James, we all know Justin James cannot take a punch. And that fight made it to the second round, dog. What I would get at is, like, he generally struggles when he jumps up. He's only 28. He's coming off a nice little win by his standard, a career best win by his own career standard, a 3-fight winning streak. The UFC calls you. You're taking it all day. But, yeah, I mean, this is the jump up that he generally struggles in. And Lontop's chin is solid. His submission defense, we don't quite know, but he got taken down by Malik Lewis twice. His grappling looked okay. I don't think that Chris Padilla has any type of dynamic grappling or submission threat for him. So, yeah, more often than not, Padilla's going to throw hands. Longtop's going to throw some hands. By the 2, 3, 4 minute mark, you're going to see that Padilla's face is starting to wear some damage. He's starting to slow a little bit, and he gets put away. He's not fully on short notice. He was supposed to fight on Uriah Faber's card a month from now, Uriah A1 Combat 21. So you have a fight coming up. But imagine you got an 8-week training camp, which by regional scene standards is generous. You got an 8-week training camp, and then you complete 4 of those weeks, and the UFC calls and you take it. You're not peaking physically. I can't imagine his cardio is deadlocked. Huge opportunity, I get it, but long top rightful favorite.
Vana Petrovic takes on Na Liang. Petrovic -450 favorite. Na Liang can be had for +360. Na Liang's fights are fun, at the very least, but the level of skill leaves a lot to be desired. Gasses out pretty fast. Under machine. I mean, outside of, I guess she got into the second round against JJ Aldrich and Ariane Carnelosi, but all of her fights, you know, before that on like the regional scene and stuff, all kill or be killed, first round finishes type of thing. Yeah, she's here for a good time, not a long time. That's probably why she's on a 3-fight losing streak and she's getting a fourth opportunity here. Big underdog. Petrovic hasn't historic. Well, I guess she actually does have, like, most of her fights have, you know, been by finish. You know, debut against Luana Carolina, who's not all that bad. Took the L. But what are your thoughts here, Cody? It's pretty hard to pull the trigger on Na Liang. Like, she may even have a point or two early in round one where, like, you know, she's looking like she's getting some wheels in motion here. Oh my God, maybe she's going to pull off this upset. But it's like, she gasses. And in this division, that's a big no-no. Like, it's pretty hard to win fights if you can't go the full 15. Look at me picking massive chalk favorites in the ladies' divisions. But I don't know. I don't have the courage to pull a trigger on Na Liang. What about you?
Yeah, it's tough to pull the trigger. Just again, you're not going to love this number. If anything, maybe look at it from a live betting perspective. Na Liang, not very talented, but she gives it hell for that first round and a half if she can make it that far. She's competitive in a lot of these fights until she's not. So again, from the live betting perspective, you might be able to find a better number on it if Petrovic gets taken down early or Na Liang, you know, is having some early success and she's pushing her back and she's landing some shots and you can find something mid-round, maybe at the end of the first potentially. By all means. But yeah, pre-flop is just hard to get behind Petrovic. I like her. She's another fighter that I would categorize as someone that talented on the regional scene, comes to the UFC, makes her debut, -225 favorite over Luana Carolina, who's a good fighter. And yeah, it's not for you. Not that it's not for you, but it's tough when you're jumping from the regional scene to the international scene and you got the jitters and you got the vibes and you're in the apex or you have a live crowd. It's the UFC. It does get to you. So Petrovic's case is that she started off well against Luana Carolina, won the first round against Carolina. The longer the fight went, she noticeably got tired. There's other spots in her career where she has been known to fatigue ever so slightly. Because Na Liang, who's also a gasser, she pushes such a high pace until she gasses that Petrovic could also be chewed up. Now, I think Petrovic's a better grappler. I think she has the better wrestling. I think she's the better all-around fighter. I think she goes out and she wins a sophomore fight. But yeah, I'm a little bit worried about her. Like, I thought she'd beat Luana Carolina, and she was looking good until she gassed out. Once she gassed out, it wasn't for her. That Melissa Dixon, Melissa Mullins, I guess now. Like, I liked her. She looked good on the regional scene. She comes to the UFC, and body shots, Paul. And everyone knows body shots absolutely kill. But just like, when was the last time you seen a fight end like that? You short little elbow, or short little knee to the body, and they just crumple over. Like, at this level, it's not. It's like heel hooks. Dope. Rip your knee straight out. Low percentage. So it's hard to get a read on like who's actually good and who's not. I think Petrovic is good. When you watch her on Cage Warriors, or when you watch her for Ares FC, sorry, she looks solid. She's fought at 135. I guess I should say 132. She's fought at 125. Her debut against Luana Carolina is a savvy veteran of the division who's got some decent wins. It's credible enough loss. She was competitive with her until she gasped. All good takeaway stuff. But is it enough? And with Nolly Yang, yeah, no, not good. I mean, just won so many fights in the first round. Carnelosi's not even with UFC anymore. Silva Gomez Juarez, I believe, is no longer with the UFC anymore. JJ Aldrich has got friends in high places. Otherwise, she might not be with the UFC anymore. And yeah, again, she's got the same issue time and time again. Even against JJ, she's not looking bad. Not looking bad, blows it. Against Ivana probably needs to get it done sooner rather than later, but at least we can rely on, if she doesn't get it sooner rather than later, Nolly Yang probably implodes. Largely a pass fight. Got to make a pick, though. I'm going to go with my fellow countrywoman, Ivana Pedrovic.
And finally, we got the legend of Mahashate taking on Gabriel Mowgli Benitez. Historically, kind of like two guys that have been my hashtag guys. Mahashate is a minus 190 favorite. Benitez can be had for plus 165. Banger fight to open up the card. One of the fights outside of like Pierce Onama, I'm looking forward to that one. Medic versus Means, I'm looking forward to that one. Mahashat versus Gabriel Benitez will get me to tune in for that first fight from Apex Fighting 91. I think I like the dog here, Cody. I know he's getting long in the tooth, but it really comes down to like Mahashat. I've been betting him in certain spots because he's been the underdog, and I think he's got a lot of potential, ability, power, but I think skill for skill in the striking department, he's going to struggle against Gabriel Mowgli Benitez. Benitez has like great body kicks and stuff. That could cause him some problems. And we just saw Mahashat going up against Borshev there. And it's just like when he took on a guy who has like a higher credentialed level of striking, we saw the holes in his game there. So outside of, you know, landing an absolute bomb, I think this fight's relatively competitive on the feet. So give me the guy who I think is the better technical striker at plus 165. What about you?
I'm going to try one more time as well with Gabriel Benitez. You can fully see he's not quite the same guy he used to be. He's most certainly regressing. The kicks, not as strong as they used to be. The boxing, not as crisp as it used to be. His chin, he's got four knockout losses in the UFC. And I'm not even just saying this to be a jerk or anything. Could you name a Mexican fighter who's got more knockout losses in the UFC, UFC history? I don't think so. So that cast iron durability that every Mexican fighter has, his is not quite there anymore. Like, he can get chin checked. That's the problem with him. The volume and the pace isn't quite as what it used to be, and the durability isn't quite there. So you got to turn into a defensive marvel, and he's not a defensive marvel. He should be Mahashat, but Mahashat's just a one-punch guy. He's low volume with heavy, heavy punching power. And I think there is a world where he can just wait on it, counter and land on something. But I'm with you, man. Benitez is just another guy that's fought in much higher level of competition. The guys that have knocked him out include David Onama, Billy Q, So DQ, Seth, and Andre Feely. That pretty good company, man. They're all good fighters. He fights good fighters. And I've been stressing this, even though he's been losing, his fight with David Onama, okay? He gets knocked out. He's outstriking David Onama 46-36. It's one round. They fought for 4.5 minutes. Benitez had landed 46 significant strikes in 4 minutes against Onama. Was outlanding him and he got caught. Not bad, though. His fight with Charlie Ontiveros, he landed 37 significant strikes in 3.5 minutes. Knocked out Charlie. His fight with Jim Miller, he got subbed in the third round. He had landed 80 significant strikes despite giving up 2 takedowns. So volume's there all day. It's that he's landing. He's going to get hit. As long as his durability checks out, he'll go back to landing. Against Mahashat, who's a low-volume guy, Benitez has got him all day. Benitez's takedown defense, years spent with AKA, Habib Nurmagomedov, Islam Makhachev used to use this guy as a punching bag. Probably why his chin's not so great anymore. Main thing is, his takedown defense is not bad. Yeah, Jim Miller can take him down, but let's be real, Mahashat ain't Jim Miller. So stuff the takedowns, put the volume up, avoid that one buzzer. And if you do that, yeah, Benitez wins.
Oh, is that it?
That's it. I'm ready to do the PRP and take off.
All right. Just the way that you ended that sentence, I kind of expected you to continue on. All right, Cody, without further ado, hit him with the PRP.
Yeah, so we got a bit of a greasy one unfolding. Let me just bring up the official odds because I think I'm a little short on underdogs. Vegas 90 Uno. Okay, we are going with Matheus Nicolau, Ryan Spann, Ariana Lipsky's dog number one, Jonathan Deniz, Jonathan Pierce, God damn. I guess Euros Medic, but man, like, I don't like it. Victor Henry, Michael Figlak, Dante Mays would be dog number two. Ketlin Souza, James Laltop, Ivana Petrovic, Gabriel Benitez. So three underdogs on a 13 fight card don't sound great. But again, we'll do the best of it. Hit a couple overrunners, hit a couple props maybe, and then mixed up with other stuff on other events this weekend. Yeah, you could put a little card together that you feel nice about. But who we're going to go with our top four this week, yeah, that remains to be seen. So I'm going to do some additional tape study, wait for weigh-ins, lock it all up, and then tweet it all out. But it's a greasy weekend. I can foresee that for sure.
100%. All right, that is it for us this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. For producer Megan and Cody Saptic, I'm Paul Shaughnessy saying goodbye and good luck.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.